Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. But there's rich folks eating from a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me. If they freed me from this prison, if that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line. Far from Folsom Prison, that's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org. Today's program includes Gary Wills. He talks about the extra-constitutional executive. He's a historian and author of The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian that argues that the atomic bomb paved the way for presidential authority that enfeebled Congress and the courts, and this reached its maximum with George W. Bush. This program was recorded in front of a live audience at the Commonwealth Club of California on February 11th, 2010, and it's about an hour and 5 minutes. And then, after that, Scott Horton interviews Juan Cole on January 10th, 2010. Juan Cole wrote the book Engaging the Muslim World, and he talks about Gaza's transformation into a blockaded prison and Israeli officials' involvement in Gaza war crimes, who would risk arrest if they traveled abroad, and Egypt's detention of human rights activists who bring aid to the occupied territories. This is about 33 minutes.
Let me ask a question. And that is, should the United States have dropped the bomb in Japan?
Very good question. I think not. The rationale that was come up with later is that if we had not dropped the bomb, we would have had to invade Japan and it would have taken tremendous casualties. The Strategic Bombing Survey used thousands of experts to go to Japan and study that question. And they concluded that the ability to resist in Japan had been fatally defeated. General Eisenhower and General MacArthur said invasion is not necessary. Continue the blockade and continue the firebombings. We brought them to their knees at this point. Their economy was wrecked. Their communications and logistics for supplies were wrecked. The will to fight was wrecked. The strategic bombing survey said they had all, many of them had been displaced. Curtis LeMay, in a really ruthless campaign, you know, he said, their houses are all of wood and paper. All we have to do is firebomb them, and it will create a firestorm which will race through the city and destroy it. And it did. In fact, when it came time to drop the atom bombs, Truman was told, we have to find a virgin city. We have to find a city that has not been destroyed by the firebombs, because otherwise we won't demonstrate how powerful this bomb is. If there's competing destruction, it won't work, which also goes against the idea, some had said, that we dropped the bomb on strategically important targets. Nonsense. We'd been going after the strategically important targets with our firebombs. So the idea that you had to drop it to prevent an invasion is, I think, false. Why did they drop it? Because they had to. Their attitude was, we built it to drop it. And the idea, some people say, well, we should have dropped it on Hiroshima and decided whether Japan was going to surrender at that point, and then dropped it on Nagasaki. That was never the question. Truman authorized the dropping of both bombs at the same time. And Oppenheimer wanted to drop them on the same day on two cities to make it clear how destructive they were. And Leslie Groves said, no, we can't do that because we aren't totally sure how effective it's going to be. You know, the Trinity test was under very controlled conditions. It was on the ground in a tower with total control over atmospheric conditions, no problem of flying and anti-aircraft fire and bomb bay and bomb site malfunctions. So he said, we've got to drop it in the first place to see if there are any problems that we can rectify when we drop the second one. So they were always going to do that. And the aim was to, Oppenheimer said, if we show how destructive it is, it will never be used again. People will be horrified at it. That was the aim. They wanted it to be horrifying. There was another motive. If they considered, you know, some of the people who said, oh, we're going to have to invade and it'll cost a lot. Well, the people who said that were people like Leslie Groves. They wanted to justify using the bomb. And their attitude was, if there is an invasion, or even if there's significant casualties after we have the bomb and don't use it, the American people will be so upset, especially, say, relatives of people who are killed, if not by invasion, by kamikaze planes hitting battleships or whatever. And they'll say, my son or husband or brother died, and you could have prevented it by dropping this weapon that you created. After all, we gave you the money. We didn't know we were giving it to you, but we did. And you drained off all this talent. Our top intellectuals went into this at a time when there's a great demand for intellectuals to do all kinds of other war projects. Bomb sites and radar and diffusion artillery and all kinds of other things. And you used all that manpower and all that money and all that breaking of the law, and you didn't use it? It was very conceivable to them that the president would be impeached and Groves would be court-martialed, that we had made this bomb and didn't use it. And President Truman said in the Korean War, it's a weapon. We made it. We can use it. That's what weapons are for.
The bomb has not been used in warfare since August 1945. Have we been lucky? Is there some deeper reason? And do you take any comfort from that fact?
Well, there is a nuclear standoff, and there should be. It's been considered at times, but the most overt consideration of it occurred during the Korean War when MacArthur foolishly pushed too far and was thrown back in a tremendous rout, the biggest retreat in the history of America. And there was a call to use the bomb. And Truman publicly said, I could turn the bomb over to MacArthur for use in Korea. There was such an outcry. The British sent an immediate embassy saying, you know, it's bad enough that you control. You're going to turn the control of the bomb over to MacArthur? Dean Acheson had to take him through a whole complicated series of withdrawals in which he kept the right to use it himself, but said, of course, we will not turn that right over to other people. When China first got its nuclear capacity, there was a call from some people to take out the Chinese bomb. But in general, there was mutual assured destruction. We were afraid to use it for fear that Russia had something just as bad and could use it against us. So it hasn't been used, but the idea that you have to keep it ready for use, with all of these deployment mechanisms and all this secrecy and all these agencies, has not only been maintained but has grown. And as I say, the hydrogen bomb increased the stakes and increased the necessity for secrecy and protection of our capacity. So the capacity has always been there and has always been considered vital. Luckily, it hasn't been used, and I hope it never will be. But it's dangerous simply to own these things because accidents can happen. Near accidents have happened. Submarines with nuclear weapons can go down in the sea and be brought up by enemies. Terrorists can come across nuclear weapons that are being traded around in the world. It's an evil thing to exist, and once we have it, we probably can't get rid of it easily, but we're right to be scared of using it.
I have a question from someone who visited Hiroshima recently and says that the evidence is overwhelming that it was used as an experiment. But the question is, given the influence of the military-industrial complex or the national security state in the United States, can that actually lead to the U.S. becoming a failed state in some sense, do you think?
In what way?
Well, I think that it so undermines the Constitution, that it so emphasizes the priorities of military power and security, that other aspects of public life and public policy get neglected.
Well, we can limp on with a crippled constitution for a very long time, and the proof of that is, I say, that constitution is surviving very well in things like domestic human rights. Probably what we have to fear more is economic failure, that we are spending foolishly around the world and neglecting the fact that our dependence on oil is crippling, our use of our military is backfiring. Consider, President Obama said, I'm not against war, I'm against dumb war. Well, Afghanistan is a very, very dumb war. We're throwing all that manpower and money, woman power and materiel into a country that is unstable and corrupt and based on a narcotic economy. There's no way we're going to build a secure base even for ourselves, much less for them. Our military is overextended. You have multiple deployments. You have the National Guard being used for purposes it was never originally intended for. You have our equipment being ground down. Stiglitz is very good on simply the costs of what we've done to our tanks and planes and artillery. How long can we go on doing that? It's a dumb war because terrorism is a crime, not a country. It metastasized. It's all around. It crosses borders. It has to be sought down in its separate cells by the use of excellent intelligence of ourselves and our friends and targeted actions against the terrorists. You know, terrorism now gets launched out of London. You know, that's not going to be affected really by invading Afghanistan. So I think that the drain on our economy and the oil dependence and the fact that we keep having to fight to maintain our oil dependence on the Middle East, all those factors may be more eventually destructive of us than the fact that we have ignored the Constitution.
A question about Israel, which has never admitted that it has the bomb. What do you think of this as a tactic for its security?
Well, it keeps its secrets all right. But if not, but not really. We all know. Yeah. We all know they have the bomb. It's hard to compare our national security state with other countries because they don't have the United States Constitution. They may be democracies, but they're quite different democracies. England, for instance, doesn't have a First Amendment. And it's very hard to judge. Some of the countries that are getting the bomb are autocracies. North Korea or Iran, if it gets it. So Israel's strategy is based on the fact that it's a small country surrounded by big countries, big enemies. And its only recompense is the outsized force of the atom. It's the same, by the way, that's the same calculus that Fidel Castro made. Fidel Castro initially didn't want to accept the missiles onto his island because why would he want that to be the center of a nuclear conflict when that whole island would disappear in the blink of an eye? It would evaporate if there were nuclear war. So the idea that it would launch a nuclear war and instantly die makes no sense. Why did he accept it then? It's because he knew what the American people didn't know. It's again, secrets are kept not from the enemy but from us. He knew that Operation Mongoose and other things were trying to assassinate Fidel Castro, sabotage his crops, mine his harbors. All of this was going on at Bobby Kennedy's urgent insistence. And Castro rightly thought, the military is using these things, hoping that I will respond in some way that will justify an invasion of my island by this great big superpower on top of us. And he thought, the only way I can prevent that is to accept these missiles. Now, President Kennedy got up and said, there is no conceivable defensive reason for these missiles. None at all. They only exist there for an offensive purpose to invade us. That made no sense. If they invaded us, they'd disappear in a minute. They were there for a defensive purpose. They were there to deter an invasion. So President Kennedy was lying to us, as happens with our presidents constantly under the regime of secrecy. And he didn't fool Fidel Castro, and he didn't fool Khrushchev. They knew why they were there. But if you're in the position of Fidel Castro, there's not much you can do as a small country against a big country except get the atom. And, of course, that's the position of Israel.
Do you think that's then the temptation for other small states too, like North Korea?
Absolutely. After all, we invaded Iraq because they didn't have the bomb. We have not invaded other countries that are threatening to us because they do have the bomb.
We're coming close to the end of our program. Perhaps I can ask you a rather broad final question, and that's about the Constitution put in a much broader historical context. The context of your book is the period since World War II and the impact of bomb power on the Constitution, crippling the Constitution, as you put it. How do you view this in terms of the whole history of the Constitution? Do you think there may be a pendulum swing, or do you think the institutions of the national security state will persist in a way that will continue to cripple the Constitution? Or do you think that the greater involvement of the U.S. in the world also presents challenges for reverting to a more equal balance of power between the branches of government?
Well, that's true. More interdependence, more globalization, more technology, all of those things certainly do affect the position of the executive in the world and at home. When you talk about a swing back and forth, there have been swings back and forth in presidential power before World War II. You know, you've had weak presidents and strong presidents. You've had Jackson and many non-entities. But we have never had a systematic denial of the right of Congress to declare war, for instance. We've had no declaration of war since the 1940s. We've had many before then, you know, 1812, Mexico, Civil War, World War I, World War II. They're all declarations of war. And the presidents, even the strong presidents, didn't try to deny that constitutional situation. So there were pendulum swings back and forth within a certain restricted arc before then, but there has not been anything like that since then. We went from commonplace declaration of war to no declaration of war, from some varying degree of executive secrecy to constantly growing, never reversed executive secrecy over the last half century. So I don't think that people who say, oh, their presidents have grasped at power before, why is this different? Boy, is it different.
Right. Our thanks to Gary Wills, Professor of History Emeritus at Northwestern University and author of the new book, Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State, for his very thought-provoking comments this evening. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's U.S. Constitution in the 21st Century series, underwritten by the Charles Geschke family. I'm David Holloway, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
All right, kiddos, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. It's Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. We're streaming live worldwide on the Internet at chaosradioaustin.org. and at antiwar.com/radio. And our next guest today is the author of Engaging the Muslim World. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan, and he keeps the great blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. Well, that's who it is, Juan Cole. Welcome back to the show. Juan, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm really happy you could join us today. Appreciate it. Listen, you got a bunch of great stuff on all kinds of important issues all over your blog, but the thing that I don't cover nearly enough on this show that I know you know a lot about is Palestine. And, you know, if we leave it to TV news, Dr. Cole, we'll just never know a thing about what's going on over there. And so I was hoping that, you know, I could bring you on to give my audience an opportunity to understand, you know, what is Gaza and the West Bank? Who occupies it? How are things for the people there? What's going on with these protests in Egypt? And just kind of fill us in on what is the deal with Israel and Palestine in the broad sense, and then I'll try to come up with great follow-ups and we can get into some detail here.
Yes, well, and as the British Empire was coming to an end in the late 40s, there was a question of what would happen in the British Mandate of Palestine, which had been awarded to the British Empire by the League of Nations as part of the Versailles Settlement in World War I. And Palestine, Syria, Jordan, and Israel, those modern countries, had all been part of the Ottoman Empire, ruled from Istanbul by Turkish speakers, which was defeated and broken up during World War I. So the British had this strip of land called the Mandate of Palestine, and they announced that not only would they rule it for the benefit, they said, of the Palestinian people, but they also invited the international Jewish community to come and establish a homeland there, though they promised that this homeland would not inconvenience the native Palestinians in any way. Of course, the whole thing was ridiculous, and especially with the rise of the Nazis, Palestine was one of the few places that Jews could escape to. So you had several hundred thousand of them there by the early 40s, and when the British announced that they were departing, in 1947-48, it sparked a civil war between, to say, 500,000 or so Jews who had come in under British auspices and the over a million Palestinians who were there.
Well,
and
now Jews won the Civil War. I don't think this, and it sounds silly, actually, to even say this now, but, a congressional candidate actually said this with a straight face to me the other day. There was nobody there. It was an empty land, a land without people for a people without land.
Yes, this was a Zionist slogan, Zionism being a form of Jewish nationalism dedicated to settling Palestine. This was a Jewish, a Zionist slogan of the early 20th century, which was completely untrue. Palestine, in fact, was very densely populated and was from about 1854 undergoing a big population boom so that it was becoming more densely populated all the time. So in the Civil War, 48, about 700,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed by the Zionist settlers from what is now Israel. And what we call the West Bank and Gaza were parts of the British Mandate of Palestine, which were not conquered by the Zionist settlers. Gaza fell under Egyptian influence, and the West Bank went to Jordan. But the Palestinians who lived there, for the most part, continued to have a Palestinian identity and to hope for a Palestinian state.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.